This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest is actor Jonathan Majors. Earlier this year, he was nominated for an Emmy for his performance in the HBO series Lovecraft Country. Now he stars in a new Western film, The Harder They Fall, with an all-star black cast, which includes Idris Elba, Regina King, and Lakeith Stanfield. We invited Audie Cornish, one of the hosts of All Things Considered, to do an interview for our show. She recorded this interview with Jonathan Majors before last week's accidental shooting with a prop gun on the set of another Western, Rust. Here's Audie.
Just what does it take to build a modern-day Hollywood career? Well, when I think of some of the roles that might check the box, there's the emotional turn in a quirky festival indie, a chiseled romantic hero in a prestige cable series, a gunslinger of one kind or another, and, of course, there's got to be a turn in a superhero film. Well, our next guest has checked off all these boxes barely 5 years out of Yale Drama School. Jonathan Majors had his breakout moment in 2019 in the indie film The Last Black Man from San Francisco. He later starred in HBO's Emmy-nominated horror series Lovecraft Country.
I know casting this spell can kill me, but I also know I gotta take every chance I can to live for my son.
He did a turn with legendary director Spike Lee in the haunted Vietnam vet drama The Five Bloods, and Majors shocked Marvel fans with his appearance as Kang the Conqueror in the finale of the TV series Loki, setting up the next run of films in the Marvel Universe.
There's two options. One, you kill me and destroy all this, and you don't just have one devil, you have an infinite amount. Or, you two run the thing.
Well, today we're going to talk to him about his gunslinger role. Jonathan Majors is in the Jay-Z-produced Western, The Harder They Fall. It's British director James Samuel's first feature film. The Harder They Fall is a revenge drama that imagines actual Western figures, the legendary Bass Reeves and outlaw Cherokee Bill, in a story with all the classics of the mid-century Hollywood Western: train robberies, saloon face-offs, dusty gunfights, and sunset rides. Majors plays the character of Nat Love, and Love was a real-life figure, a former slave who became a rodeo star, also known as Deadwood Dick. In this film, the character is an outlaw on a quest to avenge his father's murder. Here's Majors with Regina King and Delroy Lindo.
Where is
who?
Marsh. I'm speaking English, yeah?
I'm like English to me. Mm-hmm.
Where's Rufus Buck?
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Bass.
Judy.
If I'd known you were switching sides, I'd have asked you to come join us. You here for your damsel in distress?
You don't look hard of hearing. So I'm gonna ask you again. Where's Rufus Buck?
Well, clearly, you don't know me.
Jonathan Majors, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You're kind of a Southern boy. Tell me a little bit about your upbringing. We're talking North Texas.
I don't know if it's PC to say anymore, but I'm a military brat, Air Force brat, as it were. My father was in the Air Force. I was born in California, and then moved to Texas very early on, where my maternal and paternal grandparents are, and my great-great-great and all the folks are there. And
your people.
Yeah, the folks. And then, as you say, in Dallas, that's kind of where we kind of set up camp. My people are from Waco, Riesel, Texas. Those who know, know. Those who don't.
Now you know. And I understand that your grandparents had a farm there that you spent some time on. Is that true?
Yeah, we have a few acres down home, as we call it. There were two horses. There were a bunch of cows. We still have the cattle. There was a garden. There were some roosters that I got into some trouble with.
Exactly. How does one get in trouble with a rooster? How does that happen?
Well, I went in and I broke some eggs. because, you know, you go in, you pick the eggs up. I mean, this is real. I mean, this is some real rural country living. And I go in to pick the eggs up, and this rooster this day is just after me, you know. And I kind of look at him and go, okay, I got something for you. And so I have to be about 11 years old. So I get the eggs, and I've broken a few. And so I know I'm going to hear it from my grandma. And so I go back out. I go out with a water hose, which is murder, right? Because I got it from my grandpa afterwards. So I go back in. The rooster is like, I mean, I don't know if people know this, but roosters fight to the death. And so it was me. And at the time, I was string beans. It was me and this rooster and a water hose. And he wasn't having it. And he came after me. I still have a bit of a mark on my shin from his spur. And that was the end of that, because my grandpa said, you know, if you wet the pin down, and then the birds catch cold, and then that's the end of that. So it was a huge lesson for me. Don't mess with roosters, and, you know, be faster when you get the eggs out.
I heard you have described The Harder They Fall as a spaghetti Western. What's your familiarity with Westerns in general?
My grandfather used to have the Western Channel. On our farm, we used to sit there and watch these Westerns and watch John Wayne and then later on Clint Eastwood.
All the guys we expect.
That's right. That's right, sis.
You're not the guy we expect, though, in this genre. I mean, what's different about the way The Harder They Fall and the way James Samuels takes us on?
So our heroes, heroines, villains, and et cetera are black. You know, they are members of the African diaspora, and they have made their way to the West, and they live and operate in this Western genre within themselves, you know, within our culture, which is beautiful.
Right. It's incidental to the story, not the cause, right, and the motivation for the story.
Exactly. There is no driving plot line about this. We ain't being chased by nothing. We ain't running to nothing. In fact, we're on horses. It's quite special and unique and adds to the very classic and I think in some cases very limited Western genre as we know it.
What did you know about black cowboys, right, and that kind of part of Western history?
I had the benefit of knowing that they were always around because my folks were, as I said, like even to this day, like there's a rodeo in Killeen that my relatives actually participate in. Strongly. I mean, they're wicked. So I knew that horsemanship and the African-American culture was a part of it. I mean, I knew it existed. The way it's romanticized is something that we haven't really gotten a chance to experience. And that took, you know, some research and also took some, you know, some real questioning, you know, as far as like history.
What do you mean by that? What's the romance to your mind?
Well, the romance of horses and black bodies, you know, is that, you know, unfortunately, I mean, you had to ride a horse, right? You had to ride a horse, you had to work a horse, you had to work a mule. In slavery times, that was a part of, that's like fixing a car. Like, you had to have that. You know, you had to have that type of ingenuity, unfortunately, and to some benefit, you know, during those times. But the majestic nature of horse riding, it's not something that we are usually allowed to witness in cinema.
So, Jonathan Majors, this project, The Harder They Fall, it pairs you again with someone you've worked with before, Delroy Lindo. He was in the Spike Lee film The Five Bloods, where he played your father. In this, he plays a version of Bass Reeves, who was a legendary figure, a U.S. Marshal. And I want to talk a little bit about The Five Bloods, because that is also another film about fatherhood and trying to know and understand a father. What was it like being paired with Lindo again, who was amazing in that film, playing a kind of MAGA hat wearing PTSD struggling father?
You know, the thing about Delroy Lindo, I call him the giant, right? Giant. The thing about giant is that he and I come from, you know, very similar schools of acting. You know, he's a American Conservatory theater alum, ACT out in San Francisco. I went to school a few places.
Let's pause. You went to Yale Drama. I know we're going to skim over that, but it gets to the point of classical training.
Yeah. So, well, since we did that, I also went to North Carolina School of the Arts, which is my first drama school. If we're going to say both. Yeah. First and last name.
But I'm glad you're bringing it up because Clark Peters is in The Five Bloods as well. Isaiah Whitlock is in The Five Bloods.
Also an ACT alum, Isaiah Whitlock.
It's kind of this acting school, right? Some of the best character actors of their generation all together. And you were the young blood, right, of this group.
Which was my nickname on set.
Was it really?
Yeah, I was called Spike. Morehouse. What'd she call me? Morehouse. And then all the other fellas would call me Youngblood. You know, Youngblood.
Just to set the scene for people, you know, this movie takes place, The Five Bloods, in Vietnam. And it is a reunion of Vietnam vets who are making the trip so that they can kind of bring back the remains of their squad leader who died in the war. And of course, they're also trying to find gold that they found and buried there all those years ago. I'm going to play a scene in just a bit. But to start, set up the relationship between this character, yours, and Delroy Lindo's.
Cool. So in The Five Bloods, Delroy Lindo plays a character named Paul. And Paul is a Vietnam War veteran. He is also the father to my character, David. And David sneaks out and, unbeknownst to his father, shows up in Vietnam. The beautiful thing about the relationship is it's kind of in the fourth quarter, you know? It's kind of in the red zone. David has a line where he says, it feels like it's my last time with him, you know, just where his father is going. He is dealing with PTSD. And so it's a very taut relationship and is trying to reconnect with his father and trying to hold on to this man that he is just now, he finds, getting to know.
So in this scene, the vets have arrived and your character is has surprised your father by, you know, following them to Vietnam. And as we said, that character is played by Delroy Lindo, and here's that clip.
I'm worried about you.
What?
When I found out you were coming here.
And?
And I came to check on you.
You don't give a about me.
I do. You've been acting more crazy than usual.
Well, you consider me checked on.
You're here for the gold. Don't lie. You're going after the gold. I read Otis's emails. You gotta choose better passwords. 1, 2, 3, 4. Come on now, Dad.
What do you want, David?
Ed Equal Chef will help you find it.
Helton, no.
The authorities find out about this, y'all go back to the crib empty-handed.
So you're just a little jive-ass gangster now, huh?
After everything you put me through, I say you're getting a basement bargain.
You know, I'm grateful to Bill Black's dirtiest teaching.
You want to tell your bloods? Or should I?
That was Delroy Lindo, again, playing your father in Spike Lee's The Five Bloods. You mentioned that you two have a similar style of acting, or at least training. How does that play out on set? Can you give us some examples of what that means?
Well, I would say the biggest connection Mr. Lindo and I have is the August Wilson canon. You know, there's just there's a certain rhythm, there's a certain understanding that you know, quote-unquote, Wilsonian actor has. You know, you learn it from the language. It's Shakespearean in many ways. It's Greek in many ways.
Right. I mean, he's a playwright who was called the theater's poet for Black America.
Yeah. Or we should just call him a theater's poet. You know, he was one of the biggest titans of, you know, of language and a champion of a American experience, which is in direct contact with the African-American experience. The language that he uses, August Wilson, elevates any human being. And the beauty of that is, it is about an experience and about a culture that is so often, you know, pushed to the side. That's just my two cents on Mr. August Wilson. But any actor who has, you know, even tried to read his work aloud, feel something, understand something, and it leaves an imprint on them, and you can't help, like any of the greats, Shakespeare, Chekhov, August Wilson, to keep that in your instrument. There's a certain resonance that comes when you've worked on that work deeply.
What is it about the language compared to a Shakespeare, compared to something else, that can work its way into kind of your toolbox as an actor?
Right. So first, we'll use the example of William Shakespeare, right? The iambic pentameter, right? Di-dum, 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 di-dum. To be or not to be, that is, etc. Right. That's iambic pentameter. And you learn that, right? Some people say it's the heartbeat. You know, some people say it's our natural rhythm of speech. In understanding that, there's a certain discipline when you jump into one of those speeches. And it takes a certain amount of understanding of the language, you know, to, if you choose to, abide by it. And by abiding by it, by the iambic pentameter, you find yourself taken in a way. Conversely, with August Wilson, he's dealing with jazz and blues and music in a different way, right? So it's a whole different metronome. The opening offense is, Troy, you ought to stop that line. I ain't lying. See how the watermelon this big, talking about what watermelon Mr. Rand. What watermelon Mr. Rand? Yeah, like that, that is a conversation between two people, and it's going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And there is no caesura. There is no time to break. It is literally being in complete connection to the other actor in front of you, hearing their instrumentation as they're giving this language out. And the instrumentation is given to us by the spirit of August Wilson, by the work and the mind of August Wilson. And you ride it, and you ride it. And at the end of it, you know, you get to, come on, Mr. Death, right? Which is, you know, the climax of Troy's line, you know, come on, Death.
When I look at your past projects, you've had so many opportunities to work with actors of a certain generation. Michael K. Williams was a friend of yours, a very good friend of yours, right? I mean, he died very recently, and people, of course, know him from other HBO projects, Boardwalk Empire and The Wire. But he played a very kind of rich role next to you in Lovecraft Country as a character who is a sort of father-like role in your life. What did he teach you about acting?
The thing about acting, one of the best things about acting is don't make declaratives about, you know, something. So, you know what I mean? But a thing about acting is that acting is really an approach. It really ultimately is an approach, for me at least, to how one views the world and how one exists in the world. You know, acting is such a, you know, people can say it's subjective, you know, and like, it kind of is, but like, a punch in the face is a punch in the face. You know what I mean? Like it is what it is. Like, real is real. And there's a certain amount of expense, spiritual, emotional expense, that comes with the work sometimes. You know, it doesn't call for it all the time. Sometimes the scene is walking down the street, you know, and you can do that. You know, you don't gotta do nothing for that. Just walk your ass down the street, boy. Okay, cool. You know, don't get too creative. Just do it. You know, but then there are times when a role or a world or a project or a moment requires something of you that you've got to give because it's going to give back. And they don't teach that in drama school. They just don't teach that in drama school. You know, they can act like they do. They don't. You know, Mike was an example, and he did it without thinking. You know, it was just who he was. It was just how he operated. And that's a huge example. There's repercussions to that. But the work itself, he's taught me a lot and continues to teach me a lot.
In what ways?
Well, there's a few scenes in Lovecraft where, you know, you're shooting a scene at 3 o'clock in the morning, everybody's tired, everybody's hungry, you're either hot or cold, no one's comfortable, you know. But Michelle Shea said this to me, you're doing it for the person in front of you. That's all you're doing it for. Cameras be damned, press be damned. You know, you're literally doing it for the person in front of you. The only way you're going to do that is if you love the person in front of you. It's the only way you're going to sacrifice and give that to them. Let them see your heart. And Misha Green, our showrunner and writer of Lovecraft Country, built a relationship where that was mandatory all the time between Atticus Freeman and Montrose Freeman. And so I would watch him do that. And the amount of love and the amount of vulnerability that he would give was something that had to be matched and then upped. And that's where we were brothers, where it's like, oh, you want to go? Let's go. You know, you want to bring it? Bring it. You know, we kept upping each other, making each other better and better and better, you know, more and more and more human, you know, if that's possible.
You were born in California, and then you lived in areas of North Texas, which is where your parents were from and where your mom raised you. So you've got a little bit of the West in you. Talk about where you grew up.
It's deep because we kind of split our time between my mother's father and my grandparents, my maternal grandparents' place, which is a farmhouse we have. Down in, now that sounds luxurious, but it's just a farm, you know, it's what people do, you know, down in Killeen, Texas. And then my paternal grandparents actually just lived 45 minutes down the road in Riesel. That's the country. I mean, that's like dirt roads. Don't turn your lights out because you ain't gonna be able to see nothing on the road. Or like, let's play that game. Like, how long can mom drive with the lights out type stuff? You know, like that's fun. Like, can't see anything but stars at night. So we spent time down there, but then we also lived in multiple places.
It sounds like you moved around a fair bit. I mean, was that...
Yeah, we did. I mean, my mom had the three of us on her own, really. We had a stepfather come in at one point, and I love him. And yeah, I mean, we were a group of survivors, you know, and we just followed Mother Hen wherever she went, you know.
Why survivors? Why do you use that term?
Well, it was tough, you know. I guess not tough, it's just it is what it is, you know. I mean, it's economics, right? You got a single mother with three children, you know. I mean, there it is. We're in the South, and we're just trying to make do, you know. Two of which are boys, black boys in the South, you know, so... that's a headache. There's a sister, you know, that she's trying to, we were just spread thin. And so, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, canned drives. There's a lot of, you know, borrowing stuff and staying over places and all that. But my mother, you know, the beautiful queen she is, you know, always made it work and got us here and, you know, the later parts of my time. In Texas, you know, we found some stability, but by that point I was, you know, out the house, you know, kind of by choice. I guess kind of by choice, you know, put out the house.
I want to ask you a little bit about your mother, because she worked her way through divinity school while you were young. She is a pastor. You do speak about your acting in spiritual terms. Do you find her coming out of you in some of these characters?
Well, she's my mother, you know. She's my first hero. She taught me the greatest lesson I ever learned, you know, about, you know, humanity, especially about storytelling. You can boil storytelling down to hero and villain. Well, the hero or the heroine is, you know, he or she, I've said this before, is he or she who allows her heart to break. And I grew up in a household where my mother, you know, and I was a knucklehead, you know, but my mother always allowed her heart to break as much as she could so mine wouldn't. And I watched her. I remember my mother just... My mother's a praying woman, you know. She believes in something greater than her, you know, and she prayed over me. And she didn't let me forget that when I talked to her on the phone, you know what I mean?
Well, you're saying knucklehead, but it sounded like more than that. I mean, as a young man, at one point you were at an alternative school. What was playing out then?
Well, I think, I mean, there's a moment there, right, where, I mean, we talk about toxic masculinity, you know, you also talk about growing up, you know, and like, you know, being a little young black boy, you know, you have to, I mean, I'll say it all, you know, and I don't regret any of it, you know, like, sometimes there's so much discomfort in a young person, you know, I'll just speak to myself, so much discomfort in me, so much fear, so much anger, you know, because of, you know, in my case, you know, it's embarrassing, you know, to come home. And all your friends live in houses and you live in this apartment, or, you know, you get to the apartment and, you know, some days the lights don't come on. It's like, okay, that's all right, you know. And then the next day you come in and, you know, the door don't open. Your key don't work no more, you know. And so you just wait for your siblings to come home. And, I mean, you know, all that. There's a lot of stuff, you know, and everyone has it. You know, I'm not singular in that, you know, but sometimes you can't metabolize it properly. And I had a hard time with that.
Was it something you were struggling with as a family? And some of the things you've described are, you know, familiar to those of us who grow up having less, right? But I also know there were times when, you know, you left or were thrown out of your home. Was it something that was a struggle between the two of you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think not my mother, you know what I mean, but my mother's household, you know. So I come from a very southern house over in Texas, and, you know, there is a certain responsibility that, you know, I was the man of the house, you know, quote unquote. And there's a certain amount of pressure that comes. You don't want that.
Right. So your father was not present for your sort of early years?
Correct. Well, I guess early to later, you know what I mean? But you have a moment where you go, okay, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, my big issue, you know, the thing that kind of put me down, you know, the fighting is fighting, you know, but what really put me on the radar with, you know, the folks was, it was Christmas, and there was a Kohl's down the street, and I shoplifted all my Christmas presents. And at this point, I've been shoplifting for a little bit. I was pretty good at it, and I got a little ambitious and had a list and all. And I was going through it. I was just picking stuff up. And I got a little too ambitious. And that happened. And that got me in trouble. And then from that, the angst of being in that trouble, then, you know, you throw your hands the wrong way at the wrong person at the wrong time. And now they got you, you know. And so.
Right. So you're referring to some fights you got into at school.
Yeah. And then you're in.
You're in the system.
Out of school suspension, you know what I mean? And then you find out what no contest means. You know, it's like, it was deep.
You went through a phase of fighting. You went through a phase of shoplifting. You went through a phase where it sounds like...
You read the whole rap sheet. Wait, stop.
The thing is, it's not that long a rap sheet. And I have wondered, with a mom as a pastor, how far you really got down that road before someone yanked on your collar.
Well, I mean, the cool part about the community I was in was like... There's a lady, Miss Freeling, right, who actually stopped it all, right? She was my principal, and she said, well, you just can't come back to school anymore. If you want to, you got to do it this way, right? And so we got put in this...
And how old were you then?
I must have been 14, 15. And we had this guy named Mr. Anderson, who dealt with all the knuckleheads. And you were just with him. And they kind of escalated. Like, you know, you're right. You know, it's like it starts with detention, then you get what they call ISS, and then... Then you're out in the cubicles, and then they're just like, then you're doing your community service and all the other stuff, you know. It was a good hard hit, and it was time for it. And my mom had, you know, she had worked it, so it's like, you do your community service, you know, you do this program, and then you find theater, and let's see how it goes.
At that age, were you already acting?
Not quite. Like, there were theater classes that I was taking, theater arts. And then once I kind of hit that class, it was kind of on. Like, Miss LJ was like my first proper theater teacher, Miss Lee Jong. And it was just started with reading. You know, I think we've said, like, my mom was a pastor. So, you know, you race to Bible verses and you read the Bible verses out loud, all this stuff. You know what I mean? So, like, I was accustomed to reading, you know, and that was something that came naturally to me. And I enjoyed it. And so from the use of language and watching my mother and, you know, other family relatives use language, you know, to rally and to change and, you know, to work the church over. It was something that I was interested in.
What aspects of it drew you? Like, was it a given once you started down that path?
It's deep because at the time I was playing sports, trying to play sports, you know, I was still very much...
Am I guessing football or am I being biased because Texas?
I played football and basketball. Yeah. But yeah, I just wasn't there yet. But I did do it at my school, you know, and still got I was still around my teammates and all that stuff. And then after a while, it's interesting how it happened. Like, I quit the basketball team. I never threw up, and I threw up one day in practice, and I took my jersey off, and I just gave it to my coach and said, I think I'm done now. And I remember going home to my mom and said, Mom, I quit the basketball team. She said, what? She said, yeah, I quit the basketball team. And she was like, okay. And then that was kind of it. Then I was theater this, theater that, you know, playing third murderer in the Scottish play.
You just leave the jersey on the bench and don't look back?
I left the jersey on the floor, and then that was it. You know, I still play. I can, you know, still ball a little bit, you know, if pressed, or for fun, you know, but that was it. And I just left that behind. And I was like, okay, I guess I'm doing this now. It was something about the calm that my mother gave me, because she never let me quit anything. You know, but there's a lot of calm in her, and I went, okay, this is okay, I guess.
What did acting give you that sports couldn't, didn't?
I'm going to say something crazy. I think I was just better at it. You know, like,
that's like, pretty straightforward. That about, I can deal with that answer.
I mean, yeah, it was like, yeah, that's it. You know, it's like, this is, you know, something comes natural in a way. You can then push yourself more because you fired off enough like dopamine in your brain to be like, I like this enough to stick at it. You know, because I do think acting is extremely athletic. You know, it should be. There's a discipline to it, to all art forms, but to acting. An independent discipline that you must have in order to, I think, that I apply, right? I use my athletic discipline to my work, you know, in order to achieve certain things. Some things are technical, you know, like keep your elbow in, follow through. That's how you shoot a free throw, you know what I mean? Push to the end of the line, you know, go to the punctuation. This is technical, you know, but it's the same type of discipline.
We were talking about how you were raised, and you mentioned having a child, and I understand that your child came after you had graduated from undergrad at the University of North Carolina, before you went to Yale. And can you talk about how becoming a parent affected how you saw acting as a potential career?
Oh, I mean... My mother would tell you, my siblings would tell you that, you know, I've been pretty hard-headed from the jump, you know, from the bounce. And I remember my mother saying to me, you know, what's your backup plan, son? Ain't no backup plan. I'm going to make this work.
How did you decide to make that work?
When it was announced, you know, when I was like, wait, this is going to happen. We just did it. You know, I was like, I chose to audition for school knowing that I was to be a father soon. And got into school and committed to the school knowing that was going to happen. And to me, there was no other choice. I mean, when you're supporting your kid best you can with, you know, student loans, I mean, that's the nitty gritty of it, you know, and you know, the China bus. I don't know if you guys know what the China bus. Oh, we all know what the China bus is, the East Coast.
I do. I'm from Boston. So many times you take that Chinatown bus.
You take that Chinatown bus down to wherever you got to go, you know, wherever you got to go. And you make it right, you know, you just do the job.
You know, when I think of your last projects, when I think of two of your last projects, Lovecraft and Defy Bloods, both of them are casts that, you know, essentially have lost a beloved actor, right? Not only an actor that people love, but a really beloved figures in Chadwick Boseman and the late Michael K. Williams. What does having that experience, what has it done for you? How has it made you think about your career or the kinds of stories you want to be telling?
Well, first we can talk about, you know, Chadwick Boseman, because I think these are two examples of great men and great artists and great citizens and very human people, you know, very human men. I'd be remiss to not say, you know, also black men, you know, impeccable monuments of our culture.
Right. Who cared about representation, right? Who were outspoken even about the kinds of roles they did and why they did them.
Right, right. And so Chadwick is interesting because I actually got to witness him. Right, I witnessed Chadwick Boseman become Chadwick Boseman, Black Panther, you know, Marshall, 42, you know, Jackie Robinson. I watched it all happen because I'm in drama school looking out and being like, who, you know, they always say, you know, who has the career you, you know, where do you see yourself, you know, oh, it's, I guess it's this guy, you know, this is me, at, you know, probably 20 years old, but this guy, you know, 25 years old, this guy. And I watched him do it. And then I got to meet him, you know, and I got to talk to him. And, you know, as I say, very human. You know, it wasn't always sunshine and butterflies. These were workers. You know, they were workers. They worked. And they were constantly working on themselves, you know. And that's something I witnessed with Mr. Bozeman. And then I experienced it with Michael. So in their passing, you know, and being in projects in which we shared time, you know, you can think, okay, so what now? You know, like, if the real ones, for whatever reason, you know, keep going, what are we going to do? You know what I mean? But there's a call to action in a way, you know. It's time to, it's not even pick up the mantle. It's just keep doing what you're doing. It's like this, sis. I've been black for 32 years, you know what I mean? Like, there's no other story to tell. Whatever I do, people are going to look and go, oh, yeah, black, you know, until the time shifts, you know. The kid coming up behind me, the actor and actresses coming up behind me may not have to deal with that. But as it stands now, anything I do, for the most part, there will be someone out there that wants to say, oh, yeah, the black guy, or yeah, this, that, and the other. You know what I mean? That's fine. But what these two actors did, and here, I guess here's the mission, right? To push the instrument to a place where you transcend, right? You transcend that audience member, right? You wrap them up. And it's like, yeah, this is a black experience. This is an entire human experience, right? And it's twofold, right? If you can do that, then you got your folks also looking at it and being like, yo, that's the homie. You know what I mean? That's the homie. Because the audience is so, it is so subjective for them. You know what I mean? They will project their story onto you, whether you want to or not. So do projects, be around people, protect your heart, you know, when the time comes, you know, protect your heart. So it can be strong enough to fight when the war's on. And the war's on when you get that script. The war's on when you go to set.
Jonathan Majors, thank you so much for being willing to talk to us. This was really a great conversation.
Oh, this was incredible. Thank you so much.
Jonathan Majors stars in the Netflix film The Harder They Fall. It's in select theaters now and will be on Netflix November 3rd. He spoke with our guest interviewer, NPR's Audie Cornish, a host of All Things Considered. This is Fresh Air.